My name is Reggie, and I am an alcoholic. I think the old saying is, by the grace of God and help of people like you, and especially from the help of a guy named Tom H., I have not found it necessary to take a drink since June 22 of 87. And for that, I am eternally grateful. I'm eternally grateful to Tom for that, too. I don't know, he'd probably not even show up if he thought we'd dedicate this meeting to you, but I feel like he's definitely here, and I can even see where he sits back there. Smoke bothered him a little bit in the later years, and Tom was a great inspiration for me when I first came to this room, and it was in this room, too. Always made a little circle back there in the corner out of some chairs, and 12 or 15 of us would be here, and that old fart, and that's just what I called him, and I called him that to his face to the day he died. I'd walk in his intensive care room, and I'd say, "How you doing, you old fart?" And he'd just kind of smile, and then he'd go to complaining, and he'd go to schooling on me all the time. But the ones that you didn't know Tom, you wouldn't have liked him right at first. You would not have liked what he had to say. He was an old-time, true blue alcoholic AA. Skid Row drunk, he called himself. He's real proud of the fact he slept in the dumpsters more than he did in the bed back in those days. But you wouldn't have liked what he had to say, and I didn't either. But he would tell me what I needed to hear. And I went to meeting after meeting after meeting, you know, and the drunk personality came out to me, and they, you know, somebody told me to do 90 meetings in 90 days, and I figured, well, hell, 120 would do better. And that's what I did. But he was doing them right along with me, and at the time he'd been sober. He'd been sober 22 years when he passed away. On January the 6th, he had his 22nd birthday. He passed away in February sometime. I don't really know what the day was. It was the wrong day, I know that. I didn't give him permission to die. I needed him to stay around here and help me. I hadn't said it, but Tom was my sponsor, and I was the last, as he called it, pigeon that he had. But anyway, back to the meetings. I went to meetings and went to meetings and went to meetings, and he was there every dang time telling me that stuff I didn't want to hear. You know, I was kind of unique. I needed you to listen to me. I didn't need you to tell me a bunch of stuff. And I made myself a promise that I'd go to meetings until he missed one. And then maybe I'd just go get drunk or something, but I wasn't going to miss meetings until he did. That winter, from June up into the winter, how many ever months that was, he didn't show up one night. Well, that drove me crazy, and he lived out there kind of by him, and I called him. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Well, there's about 14 inches of snow on the road, and I'm not going anywhere when it's snowy like that." I had chains on my pickup, and I went and got him the next night. And he was my sponsor from then on. But I loved that old fart, and he helped me a lot. I'm just now kind of adjusting to the fact of not having him. I didn't know what he was doing for me. I didn't know how much he was helping me till I lost him. Which, that's the way we alcoholics get along with a lot of things. But it would be a great honor, Tom, to have this meeting dedicated to him. And again, I don't think he'd show up for it because he was just that tight. He didn't make a big fanfare. You didn't know how many 12-step calls he made because he didn't tell you. And you didn't know how many young guys he pulled out of here after a meeting and took them to the Ponders or wherever and drank coffee till all hours of the night, telling them what they ought to do and trying to help them, with me one of those included. There's a lot of people who meant a lot to me in this program. Lovely young lady sitting over here to the left is one of them. But I don't know who's going to be my next sponsor, but it'll come along just as Tom did. but they'll have a lot to live up to. I just feel honored to say a few words of him. He's a kind of a mainstay of this group in my eyes anyway. And I know he's looking down on us. Now thank you.
Telling Buddy, I said, them steps get a little higher for Helene every year. The thing that well, for you who don't know me, I'm old Helene. That's what they call me, and I love it because they say it with love, and I refer to myself as Helene, but I am Helene, and I'm truly a grateful recovering alcoholic. And Pat called and asked me to be a part of this, and she had no more than hung up until I was getting out all of these books that I've had since the very beginning of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I attended my first meeting, and I took my last drink on December the 25th of 1949. And I've got something I'd like to tell you. It's not important to anyone except to me. Through that, and I went to my first meeting, and I think people that know me have heard me say that many times. And last year, 1973, Pat gave me my 44th medallion. And there's two things that happened that day. Diane called me and she said to me, "Now, is this your 43rd or 44th birthday?" And I said 44th. And we were sitting in a circle around here, and Pat said to me, she had the medallion in her hand, and she said to me, "Is this your 43rd or 44th birthday?" And I said 44th. That's the only thing that I know that planted the seed. And I woke up one morning about a week later, about 2:30 in the morning to be exact, and I couldn't sleep. And I got with this thing about 43 or 44. And I got up and I put me on some warm milk. I thought maybe I could go back and go to sleep, but God wouldn't let me go back to sleep. And I started figuring out through the thing, and I figured, no, I'm all right, it's 44. And somewhere along before dawn and daylight, it come to me, "Helene, you took your last drink in December of 49, but you couldn't have had a year of sobriety until 1950. If you're following me, I don't know, it's through the thing that. And anyway, to make it, I know it's not important to you, but it's important to me that when Christmas comes this year, I've already got my medallion, and in case I go on, I've got it. I haven't earned it yet, but I got it. So anyway, that's just so I won't get myself mixed up. I was telling Buddy one time, I wanted to be a speaker like Buddy and Henry and Judd. And I dreamed of the day when I was going to be a big circuit speaker. Oh, I love them men that spoke. And one time there was a lady speaker come in. I never heard too many lady speakers. In fact, going back over my past, I could only remember three. And I heard B. Davis. She was the first woman that opened a women's 12-step house in Los Angeles. And then there was Lillian Roth, our Cry Tomorrow girl. And I heard her. And then this night, this woman came in, and she was the speaker. And she was beautiful. She was well-groomed. She was everything that I wasn't. And when she got up here, she said, "My name is Marcella Chapman, and I'm a lady alcoholic. And I've never heard anyone introduce themselves as a lady alcoholic." So during this time, this is insanity, if you don't know what insanity is. And I'd get in front of the mirror and I'd say, "My name is Helene Stalzer and I'm a lady alcoholic." And the big night came, and in the early days, they wouldn't let you speak until you had a year of sobriety. And I was at a meeting one night after I'd had a year of sobriety, and the speaker didn't show up, and I heard him calling my name. And I went up there and got all mixed up trying to introduce myself as a lady alcoholic. And that night was a disaster, that's all I can tell you. And from that day on to this, I have left it to those who can speak. And I went on the answering service, and I carried the message to the alcoholic who still suffers for 20 years. And I made coffee and emptied the ashtrays, and I did what God wanted me to do. It was not His will for me to be what I wanted to be, so I just came out like you did. They tell me I've got 30 minutes, and I've got to give my three-hour talk in 30 minutes. And if any of y'all know how to pray, pray for me that I'm going to get out in that South 40 telling you my life's history of what I was like and what has happened to me over the years. Because everything that happened to me when I talk is important to me, but it may not be important to you. Because everything that had to happen to me is the reason I'm here, and I got 43 years of sobriety. It's not because of my talking, it was because I listened. So, let's, as the young people say, let's get it on. And if you will just have a little, I've just got to take a little bit of time. This is where I get in trouble, buddy, is explaining to everybody what I'm talking about. But I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 11 years old. And I was at my grandfather's house. And I was in the kitchen with the kids, with my cousin and my sister. And everybody came to my grandfather's house on our Christmas Day. They said my grandmother could make the best eggnog of anybody in Carter County. And one of the eggnog cups came back, and it had quite a bit of eggnog in it. And I picked it up, and I drank it. And if you're alcoholic as I am, the feeling that came over me, and I can still feel it from the time I think about it, what it did for me. I went over, and only Buddy will know what I'm talking about. It was in a fruit jar. It was in the bootleg days. And I went over and I filled my cup. And I woke up, and it was dark. I don't know if it was morning or night or whatever. But that was to be my pattern for the next 23 years. This was in December of 1923. Yeah, I was in 1903. I was born in March 3rd, 1912, so I was 11 years old. I'm trying to get this straight. It doesn't make any difference, except that was to happen to me for the next 26 years. My pattern of drinking, I drank to get drunk, and I blacked out. I did not drink anymore until I was about 14 or 15, and that's a long story. I can't get into that. And I took my first geographic cure in 1930. I was in Ardmore, and Ardmore got too small for me. I was beginning to get into trouble, and I went to California, and that's where I spent my next 40 years of my life. And as the book tells us, in the disease of alcoholism, we never get better, we never get worse. And while I've been going over these days of my days of alcoholism, I've traced it back and I could see gradually where I got worse all the time. I never did get better. And I'm skipping now, I'm going to the year of 1949. I had got married for my fourth time. And that was addiction to me through the thing. Somewhere in my life, I thought if I could only get married and be like other people and find somebody to love me, that this thing of mine would go away. And as you know, it didn't. It got worse. It didn't get better. And I had married again on the third day of May of 1949. And we got married in Las Vegas, and I had been drunk for a year, and I looked through my purse, and it was on the 27th of June that he took me into a place where I had been three times before. It was known as the Good Samaritan. It was known as the Keeley Cure to a lot of people, and I had been there twice before. And if any of you get tired of going to meetings, come and see me and let me tell you about it. And it was awful, and I still believe they got you sober, but damn, they nearly killed you. And for a long time, first time I went, I stayed sober 2 years. The second time I went, I stayed sober a year. And the last time I went, in 1949, I stayed sober from June until the early part of December. And on the, I'd say around the 15th of December, I started on my last drunk. And I woke up in the Queen of Angels Hospital, and I had been unconscious for 7 days. And that morning, three doctors came in, and one of the doctors did all the talking, and he suggested that I go to a sanitarium and take Anabuse. And I'd been taking Anabuse before, and I almost died from that, so I knew that that wasn't the answer. And the last thing he said, Helene, if you continue to drink, you'll either go insane or you will die a violent death. And he left. He hadn't turned the corner until, for the first time, I found myself on the knees, and I like to tell you this in case anyone here that doubts the spiritual part of this program. I found myself on my knees praying to a God I did not understand, but I had prayed, but never before like this. I had prayed, if you'll do this for me, that for me, I'll do this for you. But this time when I prayed, I only said, God, please help me. I cannot help myself. And I got back, and I went home about 2 days before Christmas. And when I got home, my husband and the people in the apartment house had made me a pretty little Christmas tree. And Christmas Day came, and I went to my girlfriend's house. We seemed to all have one friend before we find this program. And she had invited us over for Christmas dinner. We took the bus at Beverly and Western, where I'd lived many years, and went downtown, got off on Hill Street, and walked over to Spring, and we passed by a hotel where he had stayed when he came into town on his days off, and we had drank there for almost a year. And he said to me, let's go in and have a Christmas drink. And would you believe that I found myself sitting on a bar having a beer? All the things that I had a beer. And I went on over to Agnes's, and they had a bar, and they had everything. And I heard myself telling her that I can't drink anything because Dave had made arrangements for me to go into this place and take Anabuse. And they told him if they brought me in sober, that it wouldn't take as long. And for that reason is the reason I didn't drink. But I don't believe that today, and I don't believe it now. I believe that God had started working in my life, doing for me what I could not do for myself. We went home, and on Christmas morning, the day after Christmas, I woke up, and I was cleaning up under the Christmas tree. And the second miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened to me. And it had to be a miracle. It had to be. I just happened to pick it up. It's just a piece of paper. And I opened it up, and it said Alcoholics Anonymous, and gave the address on Wilshire Boulevard. And I asked Dave, I said, what is this? And he said, Helene, he said, I called Dr. Solomon, that was our doctor, and he said, while we was waiting for the ambulance to take you to the hospital, he told me about an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it had been helping people like he thought you were. He didn't say the word alcoholic, I do not believe. And the second miracle had happened to me when David told me, he said, if it's all right with you, I'll go down and check it out. And maybe it's a hospital in the Wilshire area where we lived, and I'd be closer to home. And he came back with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and some literature, and he said, Mr. Curl in the central office said, if you would call and ask him, he would send a woman out to see you. Now, this was on a Monday. And Tuesday, a woman came out to speak to me, talk to me, and I can't tell you, going over this after Pat had called me, I couldn't remember too much of anything that she had said to me. But I do know that night I found I got up the next morning, it was Wednesday morning, and the woman who had called on me had called and said that she was going out of town, and she would call the office and have someone else to come see me. And I said, no, that is all right. I'll be all right, and call me when you get back in town. So in the meantime, my girlfriend had called, and I told her what had happened. And I said, I don't know where I'm going to go from here. And about 10 minutes later, the telephone rang. And this is a miracle that happened. There was a man at that house, and he had heard the conversation, and he said, has she been to a meeting? He had been on the program about 2 or 3 years, and Agnes told him no, and he said, well, she's got to get to a meeting, and he said, my wife and I will take her to a meeting if she wants to go. And she called, and I made an appointment to go to the meeting on Thursday night in Glendale. And that night, there was a man in the back of the car when they picked me up, and he was the man that chaired the meeting. And he opened the meeting, as you do here, but the only thing, he introduced himself, and then he said, is there any other alcoholics here other than myself? If so, please raise your hand so I won't feel alone. And everybody raised their hands, and I didn't raise my hand because they didn't know I was an alcoholic. And these people were shoving me in the thing there, and finally I got it up like this. And then they introduced the speaker, and his name was Chuck C. And he became Mr. AA to me. I came back and I was telling Pat and all the girls what Chuck had told me over the next 15 years. And you'd have thought I'd been sleeping with the man for all the things he told me. And the truth of it was I never talked to him one-on-one more than 3 times, and I'll tell you about that. But that night he told his story. And I don't remember too much about the story, but this I do remember. He said, he told me about the disease of alcoholism. He told me, he said, that alcoholism was a terminal disease, and this is the words he used. And he said, without treatment, it is terminal. But he said that it can be arrested, it can never be cured. And that is just as clear to me today as it was 44 years ago. It can be arrested, but never cured. And he said, if you be alcoholic, as I am, and you take one drink, he said it goes directly into your bloodstreams and into your brain, and alcohol takes over, and we're no longer in charge of our lives. Now, this was very important to me. People had told me for years that I couldn't drink, and I would show them that I someday, somehow, I would drink, and I nearly died, and I didn't know. I did not know. And he told me, he said, it's the first drink we take that causes all the problems. He said, for many years, he said, I went out with the boys just to have a drink, and he said, they went home, and I closed up the place. And I found myself on my feet, and I said, my God, I'm an alcoholic. And that moment, I knew the truth, and the truth set me free. I knew why I couldn't drink for many years. I had almost died trying to drink like other people. And they finally got me seated, and I said, yes, but I didn't have a chance. Nobody ever told me. But that night, I went home, and someplace between dawn and daylight, I gave up the fight, but I gave up the battle, but I won the fight. This is one fight, in my opinion, that you have got to lose before you can ever start winning. You have to concede to your innermost self that you are alcoholic, and not over any period of time, you will never get better, you will only get worse. And I believe that with every fiber of my being. I truly do. And now that is my interpretation of the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wished I could tell you that I didn't have no more trouble with it, but I did. instead of going to work the day after New Year's, I went out and got me a job and went to work as a waitress. That's the only thing I ever knew was waitress work. And I made it the first week, and I made it the second week. And then this insanity set in. And Dave had gone to work, and he came home about 5 or 6 o'clock. And I was just as nutty as a fruitcake. I was crazy. And I heard him say, "You might as well be drunk as the shape you're in." And that's all I needed to hear. And there was a bar right downstairs where I'd lived many years. And I picked up my purse, and I slammed that door, and I went out. And I walked in that bar, and what I wanted was a double shot and a beer. That's what I always started on when I started on a drunk. And the miracle that I'm talking about you happened in my life. I heard myself saying, "Give me a Coke." And if God knows, I did not want a Coke, and it had to come from somebody but myself. And I was so nervous that I didn't order what I wanted to, and I either knocked the Coke over or spilled it. And Hal said to me, "Are you all right?" And I said, "No, call Dave." And a few minutes, he was down there, and they went through my purse, and they found a place at 512 South Kingsley. It was a men's 12-step house. And that was where I was to go and be a member for 15 years. And in 5 or 10 minutes, we was in the meeting, and I can't tell you anything that was said that night. And I came home and went to the phone and called the people whom I was working for, and I told them I wouldn't be back anymore, that someone very near to me was sick. And I told them, well, they was pretty near to me. And I heard me telling Dave, I said, "Dave, I've had jobs all my life, and I have said I have got to find a way to stay sober one day at a time the rest of my life." And I started going to meetings. And people have heard me say, if I ever got the money, I'm going to go through treatment. And I didn't know anything about treatment. But I was thinking, while I was thinking about these things, the treatment I got there at 512 South Kingsley with those old-timers, hard-nosed, hardcore drunks, and they gave me what, I never heard the word tough love until I came to Ardmore. But they gave me tough love. They call me stupid. They call me everything, and I loved it. I'd want to talk, and they'd say, "You keep your mouth shut. You listen. Your stupid thinking is what got you here. Your stupid thinking is what got you here." And they talked to me, and they loved me. And they told me about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me that if I would work these 12 steps to the best of my ability, they said, they explained it to me this way, something I could understand. Said, "Helene, it's like an education." He said, "It's something that no one will ever be able to take away from you if you work these 12 steps to the best of your ability." And he said, "In your life and in your journey, there will be things that will happen to you. But if you have a good foundation," I think is the word they used to me, "the winds will blow, but you'll be able to go through and not have to drink over it." And that's exactly what happened to me. And they told me that I didn't have to rush into these steps. That I would know when I was ready to take the fifth step, the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe, I can't tell you, but it seems to me like it's 5 or 6 months before I took the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to work one morning, and life was so good to me. You just can't, you just don't know how well you do know, because you're an alcoholic as I am. But you don't know that the spiritual experience that you have every morning getting up, you're not sick, to be able to go to work, and the joy of being going to work and not being sick. And every week when the week was over, I had a little money to open me a savings account. And God, things was good. I never had them so good. I used to pinch myself, and I'd think, am I dreaming what's happened to me? And one morning, I went to work, and I was thinking all the good things that happened to me. And there at that moment, I took the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that God had done for me what I could not do for myself. I knew that. And I knew that I had took the second step of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the way I took the second step. Now, I don't know anybody, nobody has ever told me this, and it's strictly my own opinion and what has happened to me in my life of sobriety. I found for me that came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. It said could restore me to sanity. It didn't mean that moment. I mean, I've heard people at times in my life said that it's insanity when we keep drinking like I did for 26 years and the same results, that was insanity. What insanity is, since I have been sober, and I'd just like to share that just with you, and that won't take me very long. I was approaching my first year in AA, and I had gone to work. I had worked for 40 years off and on for the same company in downtown Los Angeles. And I would not go back because I didn't know at that time if this thing was going to work for me. So I'd gone to work a block over at Spring Street. And Christmas Eve, I don't know. And the girl said to me, let's go have a Christmas drink. And I heard myself saying, oh, let's do. And I went back on the floor and I thought, my God, what have I said? And I knew that I couldn't go with those girls and have a drink. And so, thank you, honey. My God, if I could talk any faster, they'd time me, wouldn't they, trying to get this 30 minutes in? And I said, my God, what have I got myself in? And being a good liar, I heard myself telling that woman, I said, I can't go with you girls. I said, my sister's coming from San Diego, and there won't be anybody to open the door. Well, we walked from Spring up to Hill Street, where I'd worked across the street, 16th Hill, and been in Lyman's many times. And I watched them girls go into Lyman's, and the tears rolling down my eyes, because I wanted to be with them. And I was telling Buddy, I don't know if it's insanity. The book says in chapter 3, and more about alcoholism, that we are countless of thousands of men and women who do not like to think that we're different from our fellow man, and said, therefore, it is not surprising that many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity. I did not want to feel different. And God told me in that moment, He said, Helene, you had 26 years to prove to yourself you never had a drink in your life, you had a drug. And I was restored to sanity once more. And I got on that bus and I went home. And I guess maybe it was 6 months before, I never thought, the old timers had told me, I would know when I was ready to take these steps, and that's the way it happened to me. I'm not telling you to do it that way, it's the way it happened to me. And things were so wonderful and so good. And this man, Chuck C., I was going, listening to him, and I'd sit there and I thought he was speaking to no one but me. And I told people, and I told Pat, and I told the girls what Chuck Chamberlain said. And I thought, I have got to see Chuck Chamberlain. I have got to tell him what he has done for me, Helene. And that night I waited. There was a lot of people when he'd get through speaking. He was a very popular speaker. That night I went up to him, and I started telling him all he'd done for me and all of this. It must have been pitiful. And he was not impressed with me at all. I thought he was going to put his arms and say, you poor little child, I'm so glad I could help you. And he said to me, and it's been the most important thing in my life. Everything's important, but this was important. He looked at me and he said, Helene, he said, it wasn't I. He talked about the Father. He said, I'm only a messenger for the Father. And he told me that night, he said, Helene, don't ever put anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous on the pedestal. And he said, in fact, don't put any human person on this thing on a pedestal. He said, if you do, you're going to get hurt. And I felt like a little child who had been told that there was no Santa Claus no more. And I went home, and I felt, if you ever felt the feeling of being rejected, and I thought, my hero, he just wasn't there anymore. He told me it wasn't him. And that night, I couldn't sleep, and somewhere between dawn and daylight, I knew what he was telling me. It wasn't him. It was the Father. It was the God of our understanding. So I took him off the cross, and I started searching for the God that he talked about so much. And not long after that, I found myself on my knees praying to this God that I knew had made a difference in my life. And I turned my will and my life over to him to the best of my ability. And it works, that's all I can tell you. It works. And today, Chuck used to say, in him we live and breathe and have our being, closer than our hands and feet, closer than the air we breathe. And today, when I'm all mixed up and I'm all screwed up, all I have to do is be quiet and know he's God, and the answers will come if I wait. So many times he told me that people pray and they're so busy that they don't have time to get the answer. But the answer will come in due time. And sometime he says yes, and sometime he says no, and sometime he says wait, if we don't get too anxious. But there were things in my life he tried to tell me not to do, and I had to do it like I'd always done. I had to do it my way until I got hurt. We went in business, and it wasn't God's will, it was mine. And I almost lost my sobriety over that. But today, most of the time, it is him. It is because of him that I've had these years of sobriety, and I've had a joy beyond anything that I could ever talk to you about. I think of Martin Luther King had said he'd been to the mountains and he'd looked over into the promised land, and he said, thank God, I'm free at last. And there are times in my life when I'm so full of gratitude for this program of Alcoholics Anonymous and for the people. God works through people, and the people that's been in my life that has helped me to stay sober one day at a time. And I hear myself saying, thank God, I'm free at last. I never was free until I found this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a drunk, and I had to get drunk. I used to hear an old country western song, and I tried to find it, and I never did find it. I could stay sober for periods of time, but then the time come when I had to get drunk, and I sure did hate it. And I threw the thing that. So that is, for me, that is my version of the three steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope and I pray that there's someone here that I might have said something that might made a difference in your life. And if I have, I want you to accept it with love from me to you. And if it is not to be true, I want to thank you for making a 12-step call on me. And everything has to come to an end, and so does this. So, last thing I'd like to say, if you forget everything else that I say, just remember that God loves you, and so does Helene. Thank you very much.
My name's Buddy Taylor, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. She kind of made my eyes sweat. Thanks a lot. I just love you to death. Yeah, and that's the truth. I want to thank y'all for inviting me to come down. I feel like a baby. There's almost 95 years of sobriety and with the other three, and I'm the kid. But you know, in the big book says we don't tell you what to do, we shall tell you what we have done. And so I'm going to tell you what I have done, and I'm going to stay away from opinions on steps 4, 5, and 6, and I'll tell you what's how I was guided through those steps through these two books right here. Bill said what we owe the newcomer is an adequate presentation of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. No more, no less. And, you know, I've had the very best in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had good teachers, still got good teachers. And I'm certainly no authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a real good authority on getting drunk, and that's about the only authority that I'm good at. But I'm going to stick with what's black on these pages in the big book and in the 12 and 12, because there's a lot to these steps. There's a lot to all of those steps, but especially on the inventory. And I think sometimes we do a disservice in Alcoholics Anonymous by making too big a deal out of the inventory. And the inventory is only a big deal if we don't do it. It's right after 3 and right before 5. It's just one of 12. I kind of got tickled, then I kind of got mad here. 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a woman come up to me after a meeting and kind of jumped on to me about, we were talking about an inventory, and was just up one side and down the other, and I guess my patience finally got a little thin, and I said, well, you know, and she'd been sober quite a while, and I said, have you ever done an inventory? And she said, yes. And I said, well, can I ask you how you did it? And she said, well, I had one of those guides that you see floating around here somewhere, and I did it from that. And I said, no, you probably did do an inventory, but have you ever done an AA inventory? And she said, what's that? And I said, well, it's out of the big book and out of the 12 and 12. That's where you get an Alcoholics Anonymous inventory. I don't know about these other things. And she said, well, no. And I said, well, how do you ever help anyone to have an adequate presentation if you haven't done an Alcoholics Anonymous inventory? And she said, well, I just kind of tell them what I did. And I said, well, you know, that could be good. But I don't really know about that. This is the way that works. This is a guaranteed way that I will have freedom from the obsession to drink, and as a and the foreword to the 12 and 12 says that will enable me to live happily and usefully whole. you know, after in the 12 and 12 it says in the first two steps we engage in reflection. These steps require no action, only acceptance. The action starts in 3, as Helene was saying, and that was simplified real easy for me as by a newcomer one night, and he said, it's just do right and go on with the rest of the program. You know, there's a lot of misinformation as far as I'm concerned around in AA sometimes, and they hold people up on doing the inventory, but I'd like to say or tell you what the big book says when it starts talking about step 3. And I'm going to read some of this in here because it's so important. I don't want to rely upon my alcohol-saturated brain to because I might forget something. And it says, though our decision, and it was talking about step 3, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And everybody that I sponsor just like the way that I have been and am sponsored. And this is what we do. We sit down and we go through this. And so I'm going to go through this. This is on sponsorship, so this is the way that I sponsor, the way that I have been sponsored. And the first question that comes to mind, maybe to a lot of us, is why I take an inventory in the first place. Well, up until this point, all we've done is maybe, hopefully, not drink. We've came to believe, as Helene said, and that's a process. It doesn't say exactly when we'll be restored to sanity. We've made that decision to start on with the rest of the program. So all of those I can kind of do up here. So when you start on the inventory, that's the first tangible proof that we have of our willingness to go on. And the first thing that it says in the big book, the object of an inventory is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. And when it's talking about the owner of that business, and it says we did exactly the same thing with our own lives. We took stock honestly. Then it says, you know, it talks about us having clear-cut directions, and it says first. And first, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which had caused our failure. It has nowhere in here that you sit down and write out the flaws in your makeup. But that's the first category that I think, and I do write mine down. Of every flaw of my character that I can think of, I write down under the heading of flaws. The main three that it's talking about in the inventory is resentment, fears, and sex, and how they have affected us in sex society and material security. So after I sit down and search within myself for all the flaws that I have, the next thing that I write down on the inventory is resentment, and it says resentment is the number one offender. It has a diagram on page 65 in your big book of how a diagram is to start off the inventory. The first column is I'm resentful at. The next is the cause. The third column is affects my, what I think that it affects. And so I go through that with people, institutions, or principles. Everything that I'm angry, that I'm burned up, that I'm teed off with. Everything looking backward that I can think of. After I get my three columns on my inventory, at the bottom of page 65, it says, we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. Then it says, when we were finished, we considered it carefully. There's three times that we consider those three columns that we've written down. And, you know, I was about 5 or 6 years sober before I realized the purpose, the full purpose of that. And there's a definite purpose for us to look back over those three columns. From there to the about the middle page of 66 is where we look back over those three columns. And it has to do all with anger. And instead of looking at the wrong that others have done me, I start looking there and uncovering my parts of it. Towards the end of the page of 66, after you look, review it the first time, then it has you to go back to that list the second time. And here's where it talks about I've heard about the resentment prayers in the back of the book. I don't even know where that's at, but I do know where the resentment prayer is in the front part of the book, and it's on the top page of 67. And it's when you get looking at the people that we think have wronged us, and indeed sometimes they have, by looking at them as spiritually sick people, then it kind of helps take away the load off of our shoulders. And the resentment prayer is, like I said, is on the top of page 67, and it says we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man, how can I be helpful to them? God, save me from being angry, thy will be done. You know, sometimes you hear in AA about the fourth column in your inventory, and in the middle of page 67 is where the fourth column for your inventory starts taking place. And it's the third time that you refer back to those first three columns. And it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. So that fourth column that I now start writing on my inventory is my part, what I have done. And it said, where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. And that was the hardest one of those columns for me to do, because I had always thought that other people had wronged me and I had very little in any part of it. But and another thing in that part there is it helps me to get down right size, or I found that it helped for me to get down right size. When I see that we placed them before us in black and white, I had tried to get sober many times and for several years before I ever got sober. And I half measured this, I no measured it, I did every kind of measure, but one of these steps except this way. And when I got to that point in my inventory this time, when it said we placed them before us in black and white, I would not use a blue inked pen. I got me a black inked pen. I didn't want to take no chances on me having that need to drink again. And that's exactly the way that I did. Right after where it says that my part, then I finished my four columns on resentments. The next category that I write about is fears, and the fear starts at the bottom of, towards the bottom page of 67. There's two columns for fears. It says we reviewed our fears thoroughly. So when I get ready to write that part of my inventory on fears, I review my fears. I put down every fear that I have. Then it says that we put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. Then the second column is we ask ourselves why we had them. The biggest fear that has ever been on any inventory of mine is always, and it was the first one after I got sober this time, and it was the fear that I might not be stay sober this time. And the reason that I didn't think that I might not be sober is because I'd always been a phony. I'd always been a phony around in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that was always a fear. But it's basically that simple. You review your fears, then the second column is why you have those fears. You put them down on paper. On page 68 on fears, there's a fear of prayer. I never knew that all those years that I was around. In and out, and I never knew that there was a fear for prayer. The thing that I like about the suggestions and directions that we get in the big book in 12 and 12 of Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's so simple and it's right to the point. It doesn't take them 50 pages to tell you how to do one simple thing. And it says, towards the next to the last paragraph, is the fear prayer, and it says we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us to be. At once we commence to outgrow fear. And learning that it doesn't say that fear will be lifted. It doesn't say that I will no longer have any fears. It says we will start to at once we commence to outgrow fear. And sometimes it's so small I hardly even know that I am doing it, but it's by the repetition and doing it over and over again that I do become to outgrow fear. Usually this next category that it tells us to write about in here, it starts on the bottom page of 68, and it says, now about sex. And used to, and I'm sure you have too, you be at a lot of meetings, and when it comes to this particular part of your inventory, there's always a lot of snickering and giggling around, because somehow or another we make it out to be a hell of a lot bigger than it actually is. We treat sex as we would any other problem. Sometimes we don't talk about it as much as we should with our sponsors. But I always ask the people that I sponsor with that we're neither to judge or condemned or nothing. It's just it's a defect of character. And it says in here that most of us need an overhaul in there. The thing that I find out. In my sex part of my inventory is that it has very little to do with the act itself. Those character defects and those shortcomings that lead up to, that's based on that, it's one of our instincts and probably one of our most powerful ones. It's where the inventory needs to be up, because the act doesn't take that long anyway. And so it's the character defects and stuff is what causes us trouble anyway. page 69, we have one short paragraph of our sex inventory questions. And our sex inventory questions go like this, and it says, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. And here's where the questions and how I can write out my sex inventory. And I use it in first person. It says, where had we been selfish? And I put that there, where have I been selfish? Where have I been selfish? Dishonest or inconsiderate? Whom have I hurt? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. And that was, you know, the sex part of our inventory is almost a third of our whole inventory. And something that of all the fifth steps that I've heard is what they talk about usually the least. After I write about my sex life, after I answer those questions to the best of my ability, after I get all of that down on paper, then the next thing that it tells me to do, and it says, in this way we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. And so from that, of finding out where that I have gone wrong in the past, can I shape a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life? Everything that I need to know where I'm at now in order to know where I can go to. If those other ways that don't work, then, you know, in order for things to be different, then I have to do different. So I have to do different. And so from that, I have to shape a sane and sound ideal, not for your sex life, but for my sex life, for my future sex life. And, you know, we don't judge anyone's sex conduct or condition in here. Then it has a kicker here on that things that I have to again, directions on my future sex life. And it says, we subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God, and there's two prayers about molding our sane and sound sex ideals, and one meditation that it tells us to do. And the first one is, it says, we ask God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed. I never will forget one time of this kind of funny, kind of sad story that has something along to do this. I'd watch this little girl come in and out, in and out, in and out, and everybody was trying to carry something to her than the message, and she was having a bad time of it. And so I walked up to her one day, and she was pouring coffee, and she was crying, and I called her by name, and I said, what's the matter? And she said, buddy, I just don't know if this will ever work for me. And I said, why not? And she said, well, you see, I'm gay. And I got just a little bit closer to her, and I called her by name, and I said, I'm a pipe welder. And she said, what? I said, I'm a pipe welder. And she said, what does that have to do with being sober? And I said, it's about as much as you being gay. It makes no difference, you know. No one is to sit and judge of another one, you know. And she kind of wiped away the tears and laughed. And bless her, I don't know if she's sober or not, but I'm still a pipe welder for sure. You know, of all the people that I sponsor and have sponsored, this one category that we write about and do in our inventory causes more problems to all of them, and that's the sex. You know, it seems like that my first sponsor, old man Leroy, he said, you know, you do anything that you want to do. He said, but the only time that it ever talks boy-girl stuff is in step 12 in the 12 and 12. So that ought to tell you something, you know, until you've had a spiritual awakening or a psychic change, and all you have to offer is the same old, same old. It seems as though most of the people, most or a lot of the people that I've sponsored, they'll do 99% of turning their will and their life over to the care of God, except that one thing about boy-girl stuff. That, they don't need any advice or direction, and they'll handle that themselves. Everything's just fine. Thank you. And without fail, every one of them has always come up to me and they say, "Oh, buddy, you don't understand. Please, you know, I don't understand. This is so different." Yeah, it is so different. You know, usually one or both of them get drunk, and that's the truth, and that's the sad thing of it, you know, because it was a hard thing for me when I first started getting sober and looking at the way that I had been. I'm going to read some of these directions in here because it's just, they're so good. And it says, whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, and here's the meditation. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. And always there's a little kicker, you know, and this is the one about sex. The right answer will come if we want it. The right answer is not always Buddy's answer. You know, the right answer is listening to that still small voice like you were saying, Helene. Then it says God alone can judge our sex situation. There's some watchwords, too, in here about our sex inventory. And it says, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so. But this is only a half-truth. It depends upon us and our motives. If we're sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we will believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. The second prayer about sex is on page 70 down towards the middle of the page, and it says, to sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. And thank God that Leroy pointed that part out to me, you know, because I did mess up when I was newly sober. And he never scolded me or nothing. He merely pointed to directions and suggestions in the book and told me that if I wanted different results this time around, then I was going to have to certainly do different. And so that's why as Nolan says, I hung on to his coattails and went to service meetings. I started helping drunks, and you know, and it has been and still is my lifesaver. And that's the categories that we write about in our inventory in the big book. Towards the end of that chapter, and it's in chapter 5 how it works, on page 71 it says, if you've already made a decision, and that's what we've done in step 3, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps. You know, we've got other steps to fine-tune to get these lesser ones. But and thank God for that I was only able to recognize my grosser handicaps. If I had been able to know at 11 and a half years sobriety, I mean, at when I did my first inventory, the things that I'm aware of myself right now, there's no way that I could have handled it, you know. So there's a reason for that. That's the inventory in the big book. When we get that part done, then I have the people that I sponsored to start. We'll go over in step 4 and the 12 and 12. Because it's both, I believe. And in here, and it tells another good reason why we should do it is because instincts on rampage has always been the underlying cause of our difficulties, including our alcoholism. And here again, we look at for things for sex, material, and society. Those are the three categories that will be that we look for. The first thing that I'm so glad that it was pointed out to me, because sometimes writing the inventory can be kind of painful, because you have to relive some of those things, and it's kind of easy to pick up the hammer and start beating yourself up a little bit. I've got an older 12 and 12, but if you have yours, and mine's on at the, towards the bottom page of 47, and thank God that they put that in there, and it said that we should list some assets. Some assets should be noted along with our liabilities. So I have to start looking for some of the things that are good about Buddy Taylor instead of everything that's bad. And it tells me a good reason why I do that. And it says this tends to clear away morbidity and encourage balance. As soon as he begins to be more objective, the newcomer can fearlessly rather than fearfully look at his own defects. And something else, too, of listing those assets along with the liabilities that helped me to see along with step five is I was not near as bad as I thought I was, nor was I near as good as I thought I was. You know, it just kind of, that's why I'm just kind of run-of-the-mill garden variety drunk. There's 29 questions to be added to the inventory out of the big book that's saying the 12 and 12, and it's an add to. In my 12 and 12, it's on page 52. And there's 11 questions that has to do with sex. I won't read you all of them because I'm kind of getting short on time. But there's a whole paragraph of questions, 11 questions that has to do with sex. Right after that, there's 11 questions. The next paragraph, there's 11 questions for me to ask myself for financial and emotional security that I ask myself. At towards the end of this chapter in the book, I write the questions and answers out. And the reason I do that, because it says for me to do that. So, and it helps, gives me a little time to think, because I hate to write anyway, I'm so undisciplined, but there's something kind of magic that transfers from here as it runs out my hand and gets down on paper. So it suggests for me to write out those questions and the answers. It talks about the seven deadly sins in this book, and usually we can backtrack and trace everything to one of those seven deadly sins. It talks a lot about emotional security or emotional insecurity in there, and it says the most common symptoms of emotional insecurity are worry, anger, self-pity, and depression. In that paragraph there, there's four questions that has to deal with our emotional security or insecurity, however you want to read it. And the next, something that sure enough still yet affects me is financial security or insecurity. And there's three questions about that. So there's 29 questions, inventory questions, in all, in the 12 and 12. And it says, therefore, thoroughness should be the watchword when taking inventory. In this connection, it is wise to write out our questions and answers. It will be an aid to clear thinking and honest appraisal. It will be the first tangible evidence of our complete willingness to move forward. So the only thing that's bad about an inventory is it just takes a little bit of work. It's the first actual physical work that I had to do. And you know, I'm a good worker, and I do lots of things, you know, but I've always just kind of been undisciplined and kind of lazy. When I got directions that will that has the very best for me, I don't want to do it. So it's just, I have to keep reminding myself and asking for the willingness. After I've written my inventory, then what do I do? Well, I have to figure out who I'm going to share this with. And sharing on the fifth step is the main thing that I had to look at when picking someone. I've always done it with my sponsors. A little over a year ago, I lost old man Leroy. He died, but I will not be without a sponsor, and so I have a sponsor. But the first inventory that I ever wrote, I took it with Leroy, and I was scared absolutely to death. But one thing that I did, I had two things going for me. First of all, I was entirely willing I was willing to go to any lengths for sobriety, and I absolutely trusted him. I absolutely trusted him. You know, there's conditions in step five in the book that tells me what I need to look for when I start choosing a person that I'm going to tell all, and it's all is italicized in here, that I'm going to tell all my life story to. And that he should know that he should fully understand what I'm trying to do. And he should understand that I'm on a life and death errand. And it's pretty serious, you know. It's pretty serious. In taking my first with Leroy, I was actually crying. I was actually crying. I was scared of absolute death. I knew he was going to throw me out of his house and never speak to me again. And every time he'd see me walking down the street, he'd do one of them numbers or something, stay away. And here's where another thing of that balance is, I was just a run-of-the-mill drunk. I was just a run-of-the-mill drunk. It's only big as long as I keep it inside me. You know, there was a good healing effect when I started sharing my story, and he shared some of his with me. You know, and everyone that I've heard lots of fifth steps, and I always share some of the things that happened to me, you know, and it kind of takes away, and it helps them not to take themselves so serious. There's promises through all, after all these steps, and in all of these steps, but I especially like the ones after step three and after step five. Let me read you some of these. And it says, there's nine promises in all. And it says, once we have taken this step withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. You know, I needed promises at the first of this book, because sometimes about all the promises we hear around is after step nine. You know, that was way too long for me to wait. So, you know, thank goodness that they put promises and some things in here to give me some hope at the front of the book. Leroy told me to do exactly what this book says, and I went home and found a place where that I could be quiet for an hour. And I looked over the first five proposals, and I looked to see if I had omitted anything. And I was still in quiet for an hour. That's pretty hard to do sometimes, you know. After you're just getting through doing your first fifth step. I mean, you know, you're just it was kind of tough. You know, I found out a long time ago that if I skimp on something, then you don't lose. I'm the one that loses. And every time, there's been a couple of times, but if I think of something, it's nothing ever that's really big. It's always something small, but if it is still on my mind and I think I should share it, then I always, after that hour, I call back and ask my sponsor what I should do about it or share it with them. You know, in the big book, after I do five, there's only two short paragraphs for six and seven, and I've only got six. You know, one of those promises after step five is now that we begin to have a spiritual experience. So up until this time, I've still not done anything but maybe not drink. Made that decision. I've written down a list of my grosser handicaps. I've shared them with someone, but I've still got the same old in me. So until I start, till I become willing to have these defects of character, the grosser ones removed anyway, and I had by the time that I got to that point, because the need to drink wasn't there. I still, for 8 months, I thought about drinking or blowing my head off or something, but I just kind of put one foot in front of the other. So the biggest defect wasn't there. Looking over that, you know, in the 12 and 12, it said this is the step that separates the men from the boys. And the reason that it separated the men and the boys for me is because it's real easy for me not to go down and rob a bank, because I don't like the thought of that punishment. All of these big parts of my defects of character, it's easy for me to avoid those excesses because I don't like the results that I would get. But what the true growth that I've had in this, and it's been so hard for me, is, you know, how about just a little bitty white lie? Or maybe being just a little bit dishonest. Or maybe being just a little bit lustful. Or any of those things have just a little bit of gluttony. You know, those things, usually I'm the only one that knows about them anyway when I do them. You know, when it says that being willing, the first time that I read that, I thought that they were stating perfection of having that willingness. The only thing that I've ever had is the willingness in here. But what it's talking about in step six is the willingness to aim at the best that we can learn or know and grow along from instead of having a self-determined objective and having the perfect objective, which is of God. And that's what step six means. Most of these things, you know, a lot of people, myself included, when I first got to step six, I thought, Ben's, that I had done everything, those first five steps, the best that I could. When I got to step six, after making that review for an hour, that I was willing, then those things are just going to be lifted up for me, and I was just going to be able probably to walk on water or something. That's not the way it is. I don't know of anybody yet that can walk on water. You know, and it talks about patient improvement. You know, there are certain things that are going to be a part of my character from now on. You know, it's how far I take those or allow them to go. One time, that's kind of embarrassing, but one time I got in a fuss at work and I picked up a 24-inch pipe wrench and I was fixing to hit a home run on my foreman. But I didn't, and I stopped, and I went back about 5 minutes later, and I made amends for the way that I had acted, and it just bothered me something terrible, and I called old man Leroy, and I was talking to him about it, and he said, you know, it's kind of crude, but that is progress on, he said, before, if you'd been drinking, and if you'd been exercising that defect really good, you would have hit him, you know, and he said, it's those lengths that we used to allow those defects of character to take us. This next time that happens, we stop short of where we used to go. Progress. You know, I'll never be free of anger. You know, steps 2 through 12, when it talks about this in step 6, it says only step 1 can be practiced with 100%. Steps 2 through 12 state perfect ideals. And so the perfect eye in a way which we can measure and estimate our progress. So I can't, not using it as an excuse for bad behavior or anything else, but I've got to remember that I'm just human and always will be human. The worst thing that I can do in step 6 is quit being willing to grow towards that ideal. One of the things that I like is old man Leroy and another old timer, when I got to this point, they said, please do yourself a favor, because there's only that much in the big book about it. Read and study, read and study, read and study in the 12 and 12. And I thank God for that, because these are a part of my life. All steps are, but especially 6 and 7. You know, because after I become willing, then I got to have something. I got to know what to do with it. And I don't mean to get in Henry's, but those are the one that keep me growing. You know, because now is the first time that I actually start trying to do something about what has made a problem drinker out of me anyway. And I hope I didn't run over, but thank you for having me here, and God bless y'all.